all my creative writing classes were independent studies. So I learned nothing. And I mean that seriously in a way. There was no, you know, they read what I wrote, but no one had any formal training and said, you know, today we're going to do this, today we're going to do this. And so I never learned anything about forms. And I was interested in them. Well, it took me 25 years to do anything about that, but, you know, interest sometimes blooms slowly. And I wanted to learn particularly about sonnets. And someone suggested that I learn that by reading Shakespeare and trying to, Shakespeare sonnets and trying to imitate them, which I did, and I came out with some highfalutin sonnets that really had nothing to do with anything. I mean, they just sounded very pompous, actually. Until I read Marilyn Hacker's book, Love, Death, and the Changing of the Seasons. And I don't know if someone recommended that, or well, I'd certainly like to think I just found it on my own and it seemed right. And I stayed in bed three nights reading it. I mean, I got up during the day, and don't be concerned. But the last night, I grabbed the notebook I keep above me and wrote a sonnet. And it was so life-changing for me because those sonnets, your sonnets, were about real things in ordinary language. I enjoyed the humor of the way words were divided, and it was much more tangible to me. I had certainly heard Marilyn Hacker's name and read some of her poetry over time, but that book was a real turning point for me. And I feel very privileged to be able to listen to you read tonight and to have you here with us. Marilyn Hacker, I have several pages of biography that you could come around later and borrow if you'd like. We just won't take the time to do it right now. Let me just tell you that she has received the National Book Award, the Lenore Marshall Award in 1995. That book was also a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist. She's had two Lambda Literary Awards, been editor of several literary magazines, including the Kenyon Review for 4 years, was the judge for our River Styx, our first poetry contest last year, and divides her time between New York and Paris. She has flown directly from Paris this evening to be with us tonight. I don't even live in this world, but I'm very proud to introduce Marilyn Hacker.
Thank you, Janie, and thank you all for deserting the Academy Awards this evening. If the people sitting at the bar want to, you know, come and sit in here, there's plenty of room. I'm going to start with a poem for two friends who are no longer here, both activists and poets, Sonny Wainwright and Audre Lorde, year's end. Twice in my quickly disappearing 40s, someone called while someone I loved and I were making love to tell me another woman had died of cancer. 7 years apart and two different lovers, underneath the numbers, how lives are braided, how those women's deaths and lives, lived and died, were interleaved also. Does lip touch on lip a memento mori? Does the blood thrust nipple against its eager mate recall through lust, a breast's transformations sometimes are lethal. Now or later, what's the enormous difference? If one day is good, is a day sufficient? Is it fear of death with which I'm so eager to live my life out now and in its possible permutations with the one I love? Only 4 days later, she was on a plane headed west across the Atlantic, workbound. Men and women mortally wounded where we love and nourish, dying at 30, 40, 50, not on barricades, but in beds of unfulfilled promise. Tell me, senators, what you call abnormal. Each day's obits read as if there's a war on. 58-year-old poet dead of cancer. Warrior woman laid down with the other warrior women. Both times when the telephone rang, I answered, wanting not to, knowing I had to answer. Go from two bodies' infinite approach to a crest of pleasure, through the disembodied voice from a distance, saying one loved body was clay, one wave of mind burst and broken. Each time we went back to each other's hands and mouths as to a requiem where the chorus sings death with irrelevant and amazing bodily music. Since Janie talked so generously about Love, Death, and the Changing of the Seasons, I will read some from there. It's a novel told almost entirely in sonnets, the story of a year-long relationship between an older woman and a younger woman. Using that form for a sustained narrative was, I found, at least as much like making a film as it was like writing a novel. I mean, you didn't have to do all that connective tissue part of getting, changing scenes and getting characters from one place to another. Rather, you could sort of zoom in on them and then black out and then zoom in again to, and after you'd seen a certain setting a couple of times, whether it was a room or a street corner or a face in a crowd who's then seen, you know, again at a table in a cafe with the protagonist, you get some idea who they are. Right at the beginning, if the this putative filmmaker were looking for a place where two people who are not yet lovers might meet, there really was at the time a restaurant and bar called Runaway's Cafe on Lexington Avenue in New York, and so that is the setting for these first two, Runaway's Cafe 1. You hailed a cab outside the nondescript yuppie bar on Lexington to go downtown. Hug, hug. This time I brushed my lips just across yours, and fire down below in February flared. Oh, bless and curse what's waking up no wiser than it was. I will not go to bed with you because I want to very much. If that's perverse, there are, you'll guess, perversions I'd prefer. Fill the lacunae in. 1, 2, 3, 4. I did. Cab gone. While my late bus didn't come, desire ticked over like a metronome. For you, someone was waiting up at home. For me, I might dare more if someone were. This is the second Runaway's Cafe. After a week or so has passed. For once, I hardly noticed what I ate, salmon and broccoli and Saint-Vérin. My elbow twitched like jumping beans. Sweat ran into my shirt sleeves. Could I concentrate on anything but your leg against mine under the table? It was difficult, but I impersonated an adult, looking at you and knocking back the wine. Now that we both want to know what we want, now that we both want to know what we know, it still behooves us to know what to do. Be circumspect, be generous, be brave, be honest, be together, and behave. At least I didn't get white sauce down my front. "5:30, little one, already light outside. From Spanish Harlem, sun spills through the seamless windows of my Gowa's blue bedroom where you're sleeping. With what freight of dreams? Blue boat, I'll navigate and pilot this dawn watch. There's someone who is dying, darling, and that's always true, though skin on skin we would obliterate that fact, and mouth on mouth alive have come to something like the equilibrium of a light skiff on not quite tidal waves. And aren't we, when we are on dry land with shaky sea legs, walking hand in hand, often enough, reading the lines on graves. In Budapest in 1943, Ergy and her pretty journalist friend who topped the Nazis' wanted list sooner smile at each other on a windy hill under an arch in spy movie suits with shoulder pads. She has one fist raised in this one, party salute. The distance between these points, my history laid across theirs. The blonde knew when to split and did. She writes long letters now from Queens to Ergy, bookbound on the Buddha side of the Danube. They weren't the ones who died, and we wonder, like conscripts in their teens, would we be heroes if things came to it? Where can we be quiet? On the tar beach above 23rd Street, with the sun setting behind the sweatshops, we found one oasis where we pitched our tent. The car, when you're not driver to the commissar, sometimes becomes a silvery cockpit encapsulating pilot and co-pilot beyond ground time, alone between departure and arrival. Restaurant tables make adequate islands when they're set for two, too seldom. Sometimes when you sing, your voice is something like a path around a lake. Sometimes even your white room or my blue one's the sufficient, necessary place. How can you love me with the things I feel that scare me crashing on the window glass? How can you love me when I'm such an asshole sometimes? I can't take hold of what's really there and use it. Let you take the wheel and put my head back as the truck stops pass. Where would we go that morning? Would the grass beside the highway mount to granite, steel and rubber take us far enough that I could pull my ghosts out of my guts and cry for them with you behind me on some high stone place where water breaks from underground arteries with hard breaths that would sound like mine, letting them go, saying goodbye? This is a very different poem. It's called Part of a True Story. And it's in the form of a letter. The letter is addressed to Mrs. Amelia Bloomer, who was the originator of the Bloomer suit, wide trousers for women, this in the mid-19th century, so that they could walk, even ride bicycles more freely, uncorseted. She was also a leader in the abolitionist movement and in the movement for women's suffrage, and the editor of the first feminist journal published in the United States, which was called The Lily. So this is a letter to her. It's called Part of a True Story, and it has an epigraph from an untitled poem by Entozaki Shange, which is, "We Dress Up." My dear Mrs. Bloomer, the exigencies of my life demand rational costume. I noticed recently upon perusal of a number of your interesting journal, The Lily, that your radical bifurcate garment for gentlewomen is, beyond suggestion, not to mince words, for sale. My people, Mrs. Bloomer, are as well south of the district, and until the last and least of us no longer is chattel, this woman must be radical to be rational. A woman of color is gentle as yourself until provoked. I have been since the age of 6. When I, age 20-some, returned to the scene of my truncated childhood with the goal, which I achieved, of bringing forth my mother and my father from bondage, as I had my brothers, many of my sisters and brothers, I was obliged, for my safety and theirs, to come to them in male attire. Does attire have gender? I cannot pass as other than I am in one respect, nor would I wish to. It was curious passing that other way, where I had passed before. This gal can haul as heavy a load as 3 men or a mule, etc. A black man is only marginally more anonymous on a southern road than a black woman. Dare I confess I liked that marginal anonymity? Crop-headed in a neutral suit of clothes, I sat, a stranger, at my mother's table, bearing good news she could not bear to hear, who bore me till I bared myself as well, scarred as I was to loving scrutiny. Later, I also bore the scrutiny of the spouse whom I had reluctantly left, who, free, had forbidden me to go toward freedom. Newly wived, he did not know me at all, either as woman or as myself. It's a peculiar thing to pass easily, anonymously, from one life or mode of life to another, done with a forked suit. Night, starvation, a gun to scare stragglers to courage, sleep in snow or straw or not at all, are what I know as passage rites. I do what I can, but I do not wish to be thought a man again. Tonight, 400 human souls, still embodied, disembondaged, lie wakeful or sleep in this rough but hospitable hospice, this time taken across water to free land. You know the name I am called. The Straits do not. We cross them nonetheless. I have another name now, General, a task I had first as a nursling, nurse. We intend to bring out 400 more. I wish to be there. It is efficacious that I be there. I must be recognized, though, black, female, and old, or nearly old. Still, I am of scant use immobilized. I wish to be relieved of the woolen gown whose waterlogged skirts and underskirts held me so, as well as the Confederate Army would wish. I was nearly drowned. Thus, Mrs. Bloomer, my request. Disguise is not wished or called for. Compromise, though unaccustomed, is appropriate on this occasion. So is the connection of our aims. I entertain reflection that, free and black, I am still disfranchised female, a condition I first realized espoused, bondswoman and freedman, we embodied it. I transcend limitation. I am a black woman whose education was late and little, necessity of adulthood vowed to emancipation of my people, the larger limitation imposed by childhood spent in servitude, leave me comparatively unlettered. You will receive this missive dictated by me to my adjutant from her hand, to which I pray you will deliver the costume I desire. Awaiting your kind reply, I remain yours faithfully, Harriet Tubman, United States Army, Medical Division, Port Royal Island. And though the words clearly are mine, the story is true. The one campaign of the United States Army that has so far been led by a woman was the Combahee River campaign, led by Harriet Tubman, in which Union Army boats crossed to the mainland from the Georgia Sea Island to bring all in all, in the two parts of the campaign, over 800 people out of slavery. And in the second part of that campaign, she did indeed wear a Bloomer suit, which she had ordered from Amelia Bloomer for that purpose. Different tone. This is a poem for my friend, poet and novelist, Julie Fay. It's called Country and Western. It looks like we are the last unmarried women in Tucson. We talk about food, drinking, and mountains. They talk about babies. We're going to have to go outside to smoke. Is there any more bourbon in the car? It's too early to want to go to bed in sleeping bags indoors. Fun in bed in Tucson happens after you get married. Why, every teenager has got a car. As Carol peeled and chopped, we talked about food we'd cooked at campsites, mole con charcoal smoke for two nights running. She talked about babies, and I remembered talking about babies incessantly when I had one in bed in a basket under my desk. I'd smoke, swill coffee, and discuss her. I stayed married for 9 months after that. We talk about food in the morning while you waltz the car around the mall for space next to a car bigger enough to vouchsafe shade. A baby's on board, decals announce. We talk about food on down the giant's 12 aisles, each one a bed of Procrustes. Do you want to get married, and why? There's fire, but you've had all that smoke in your eyes before. If I could smoke dope without crashing, I'd say, let's take the car up one of your mountains. Sunset married to sky, we gaze, get high. If Carol's babysitter showed up, Carol would come, but her bed and boardmate would get home and want his food. Oh, even gorged with cheap Mexican food, the counterculture, rounding 40, smoke defiantly, hint an unlicensed bed or two, have drinking buddies now incarcerated, still had curfews, home to babies. A toast first to these two who just got married. The rest, like me, married when they were babies. Before bedtime, we'll toast your yellow car, smoke while we watch the stars, and talk about food. One of the nice things about having a selected poems that are is having your oldies and goodies, oldies but goodies, at least you hope they still are, from way back when, back in print. This one is an elegy for the rhythm and blues singer Janis Joplin, rock, rhythm and blues, whatever you want, at which Yusuf Kumanyaka and Sasha Feinstein later on kindly included in an elegy, an anthology of jazz poetry. And so, since you liked it well enough to put it in there, read it now. I never actually knew Janis Joplin, but we used to play pool in the same bar in San Francisco. Crying from exile, I mourn you, dead singer, crooning and palming your cold cheeks, calling you, you. A man told me you died. He was foreign, I felt for the first time, drunk in his car, my throat choked. You won't sing for me now. Later, I laughed in the hair between his shoulder blades, well enough loved in a narrow bed. It was your southern comfort grin stretching my mouth. You were in me all night, shouting our pain, sucking off the mic, telling a strong-headed woman's daily beads to dumb kids screaming on your high notes. Some morning at wolf hour, they'll know. Stay in my gut, woman lover I never touched, tongued, or sang to. Stay in back of my throat, sandpaper, velvet. Janice, you overpaid your dues. Damn it, why are you dead? Cough up your whiskey gut demon, send him home howling to Texas, to every fat, bristle-chinned white motel keeper on Route 66, every half-Seminole waitress with a crane's neck, lantern-jawed truck driver missing a finger joint, dirt farmer's blonde boy with asthma and sea dreams, 21-year-old mother of three who got far as Albuquerque once. Your veins were highways from Coca-Cola flatland, dust and dead flies crusting the car window till it rained. Drive anywhere out of here, the ratty upholstery smelling of dog piss and cunt. Bald tires swiveled and lurched on slick macadam, skidding the funk in your mouth to a black woman's tongue. Faggots and groupies and meth heads loved you. You loved bodies and booze and hard work and more than that, fame. On your left tit was a tattooed Valentine, around your wrist a tattooed filigree, around your honeycomb brain webbed Klieg lights and amp circuits screamed, love, love, and the booze skag and cocaine baby twisted your box, kicked your throat, and the songs came. I wanted to write your blues, Janice, and put my tongue in your mouth that way. Lazy and grasping and treacherous, beautiful insomniac freaking the ceiling, the cold smog went slowly blue, the cars caught up with your heartbeat. Maybe you were not alone, but the ceiling told you otherwise, and Skag said, you are more famous than anyone out of East Texas. Your hair is a monument, your voice preserved in honey. I love you, lie down. I am in London, and you more meat than Hollywood swallowed. In Hollywood, more meat. You got me through long nights with your coal scuttle panic. Don't be scared to scream when it hurts, and oh, mother, it hurts. Tonight, we are 27. We are alone. You are dead. Janie mentioned that I do indeed most of the time divide my life between New York and Paris, which sounds very glamorous, except no city is particularly glamorous when you live there. It's just, you know, where you have your friends and do your shopping and do your work, you hope. And This is a Paris one. It's called Quai Saint-Bernard, which is an outdoor park with sculpture garden right alongside the river, just about 10 minutes away from where I live. I take my Sunday exercise riverside, not quite a local, not quite a transient. Dutch houseboats, gravel barges, nose by teenagers tanning in day-glow gym shorts. Waves, slick as seal pelts, undulate after like sun-dappled, ludic sexual animals, if you ignore the floating garbage cast by the strollers and weekend sailors. Three German students nap on their sleeping bags, backpacks and water bottles niched next to them, up on the slope of lawn beside the playground, as safe as suburban puppies. While underneath a willow, a family, blonde woman, man like African ebony, her mother, almond golden toddler, picnic on camembert, bread, and apples. I bring my books to sit in my favorite spot, concrete steps that arc in a half circle out from the water. Sometimes barges pull up and tie up beside my elbow. Shit, someone's standing inches in back of me with all this space. From vision's periphery, I just can make out it's a woman, so I relax. Then she walks around me on down the quay, a derelict madwoman, drunk, drugged, or tranced, long hair to her knees, with bare feet, flowered blouse, and filthy trousers, teetering there like a tightrope walker. She pauses, kneels down, flinging her copious brown half-soaked hair, a blindfold, in front of her, so she can't see where she is going, inches away from the churning water. Who stops her, leads her farther away from the edge, even asks her what she was doing there? I don't, although she'd come so close her serpentine shadow fell on my notebook. She halts and sways in front of a sunbathing young man engrossed in reading a paperback. We others watch her staring at him, grateful we aren't the one she's chosen. No crisis, she traverses the half-circle stone steps away from water and audience, sits in the dust behind a basalt statue, lies down like exhausted dogs do. So I dismiss her, turn back away from her. So does the almost naked man opposite. We read, relieved of ever knowing even what language she might have spoken. And this is another... I live in the 3rd arrondissement in the Marais, which is the... In the midst of the oldest Jewish quarter in Paris, which has been so since the 15th century. Of course, a lot of the people who would be who would have been my neighbors now were deported in between 1940 and 1944. So these two are called from a series called Street Scenes. After lunch, the Sunday strollers boil on the pavement 2 miles from Belleville, which may be the upcoming quartier now that fashion's priced out the Marais. Stretch silk jeans, antiqued American patchwork quilts, hand-sewn, but in Taiwan. Ragdoll black girls and ragdoll Uncle Sam's are sold in what still was the Hammam Saint-Paul last year. There, Jewish matrons, girt with goose fat, had their nails done, had dessert and some discreet attention to their hair, had tea and time to gossip in lounge chairs on steaming tiles beside the pool or nap. Their granddaughters and foreigners swam laps, sweated, were flogged with twigs, were rubbed and rolled over, kneaded and pummeled, doused with cold water to join them panting on the tiles or risk the verdict of the 8-foot scales. The Jewish matrons were Tunisian Jews. The French Jews mostly disappeared in 42, the Vélodrome d'Hiver, Beaune-la-Rolande, Drancy, then the trains. Their street is being frosted to a myth. The cowboy boutique rubs door sills with a new shop selling Yemenite cassettes and hand-painted Israeli Seder plates. Ben Simon the butcher coexists with an architectural palimpsest of doors and windows, heavy oak and brass 400 years old, filigree and glass of the last fin de siècle, fresh concrete pavement of this one, widening the street so international pedestrians can loiter. Redispersed Jews seeking roots, they price the impossible purple snakeskin boots and queue for lunch at the falafel stands with sallow cousins in ageless black coats. Another from the street scene series. The German tour bus pulls out of the sleepy street. No one is sorry. After group dinner, they sang group songs in German under our windows. Neighbors remember songs in the street like that in 1941. They're European brothers and sisters now, but they pull their curtains. Two streets over, some neighbors didn't come back from the Veldive, Drancy. They were babies in 41, or not born, those charter bus singers. There were babies behind barbed wire at Drancy. When should they have been born? A couple of love poems, or sort of love poems. This is called Nearly a Valediction. You happened to me. I was happened to like an abandoned building by a bulldozer, like the van that missed my skull happened a 2-inch gash across my chin. You went as deep down as I'd ever been. You were inside me like my pulse, a newborn flailing toward maternal heartbeat through the shock of cold and glare. When you were gone, swaddled in strange air, I was that alone again, inventing life left after you. I don't want to remember you as that 4 o'clock in the morning, 8 months long, after you happened to me like a wrong number at midnight that blew up the phone bill to an astronomical unknown quantity in foreign currency. The dollars dived since you happened to me. You've grown into your skin since then. You've grown into the space you measure with someone you can love back without a caveat. While I love somebody I learned to live with through the downpulled winter days, routine wakings and sleepings, half and half caffeine-assisted mornings, laundry, stockpots, dust balls in the hallway, lists instead of lust sometimes, instead of longing, trust that what comes next comes after what came first. She'll never be a story I made up. You were the one I didn't know where to stop. If I had blamed you, now I could forgive you. But what made my cold hand back in proximity to your hair, your mouth, your mind, want where it no way ought to be, defined by where it was and was and was, until the whole globed swelling liquefied and spilled through one cheek's nap, a syllable, a tear, wasn't blame, whatever I wished it were. You were the weather in my neighborhood. You were the epic in the episode. You were the year poised on the equinox. This is called, back in France again, in the country this time, it's called For KJ Leaving and Coming Back. Several times we've rented small houses from people in small villages in various parts of France for a month or two in the summer. And often houses that one hasn't seen ahead of time and just know where it is and have perhaps been through the town and have a key sent to you in the mail. And this was one of these occasions. August 1st, it was a year ago, we drove down from Saint-Guillaume-le-Désert to open up the house in Saint-Guiraud, rented unseen. I'd stay, you'd go. That's where our paths diverged. I'd settle down to work. You'd start the next month of your Vendéjahr. I turned the iron key in the rusted lock. It came like a detective story clue in a manila envelope, postmarked elsewhere, unmarked otherwise, while you stood beside me in the midday heat. Somnolent shutters marked our progress. Two horses grazed on a roof across the street. You didn't believe me till you turned around. They were both old, one mottled gray, one white. Past the kitchen's russet dark, we found bookshelves on both sides of the fireplace. Verlaine, L'Étranger, notes from the underground. Through an archway, a fresh plastered staircase led steeply upward. In a white room stood a white-clad brass bed. Sunlight in your face came from the tree-filled window. You did good. We laid crisp sheets we would inaugurate that night, rescued from the grenier, a wooden table we put under the window. Date our homes from that one, to which you returned the last week of August on a late bus in shorts, like a crew-cut sunburned bidas. Sunburned in shorts, a new haircut with Auden and a racing pulse I'd earned by not being sentimental about you, I sprinted to La Populaire. You walked into my arms when you got out. At a 2-minute bus stop, who would care? La Populaire puffed onward to Milo while we hiked up to the hiatus where we'd left ourselves when you left Saint-Guiraud after an unambiguous decade of friendship and some months of something new. A long week before either of us said a compromising word acknowledging what happened every night in the brass bed and every bird heralded blue morning was something we could claim and keep and use, was, like the house, a place where we could bring our road-worn, weary selves. Now we've a pause in a year we wouldn't have wagered on. Dusk climbs the tiled roof opposite, the blues still sun-soaked. It's a week now since you've gone to be a daughter in the capital. I came north with you as far as Beaune. I cook things you don't like. Sometimes I fall asleep, book open, 1 a.m. Sometimes I long for you all night in Provençal or Languedoc or wish I could when I'm too much awake. My early walk, my late walk mark the day's measures like rhyme. There's nothing that I hate. Perhaps I hate the adipose deposits on my thighs as much as having to stay put and wait. Although a day alone cuts tight or lies too limp sometimes, I know what I didn't know a year ago that makes it the right size, own certainty, perpetual surprise. And I think I'll close with another older poem. Called Iva's Pantoum. Iva is my daughter, and a pantoum is a Malaysian form in quatrains with where the second and fourth lines of each stanza become the first and third of the one that follows until it ends up more or less with its tail in its mouth like the worm Aruberus. Iva's Pantoum. We pace each other for a long time. I packed my anger with the beef jerky. You are the baby on the mountain. I am in a cold stream where I led you. I packed my anger with the beef jerky. You are the woman sticking her tongue out in a cold stream where I led you. You are the woman with spring water palms. You are the woman sticking her tongue out. I am the woman who matches sounds. You are the woman with spring water palms. I am the woman who copies. You are the woman who matches sounds. You are the woman who makes up words. You are the woman who copies her cupped palm with her fist in clay. I am the woman who makes up words. You are the woman who shapes a drinking bowl with her fist in clay. I am the woman with rocks in her pockets. I am the woman who shapes. I was a baby who knew names. You are the child with rocks in her pockets. You are the girl in a plaid dress. You are the woman who knows names. You are the baby who could fly. You are the girl in a plaid dress upside down on the monkey bars. You are the baby who could fly over the moon from a swinging perch upside down on the monkey bars. You are the baby who eats meat. Over the moon from a swinging perch, the feathery goblin calls her sister. You are the baby who eats meat the bitch wolf hunts and chews for you. The feathery goblin calls her sister. You are braver than your mother. The bitch wolf hunts and chews for you. What are you whining about now? You are braver than your mother, and I am not a timid woman. What are you whining about now? My palms itch with slick anger, and I'm not a timid woman. You are the woman I can't mention. My palms itch with slick anger. You are the heiress of scraped knees. You are the woman I can't mention to a woman I want to love. You are the heiress of scraped knees. Scrub them in mountain water. To a woman, I want to love women you could turn into. Scrub them in mountain water. Stroke their astonishing faces. Women you could turn into the scare mask of bad mother. Stroke their astonishing faces in the silver scratched sink mirror. The scare mask of bad mother crumbles to chunked pinched clay, sinks in the silver scratched mirror. You are the little robber girl who crumbles the clay chunks, pinches her friend, gives her a sharp knife. You are the little robber girl who was any witch's youngest daughter. Our friend gives you a sharp knife, shows how the useful blades open. Was any witch's youngest daughter golden and bold as you? You run and show how the useful blades open. You are the baby on the mountain. I am golden and bold as you. You run and we pace each other for a long time.